Hey, good evening, everybody. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts, where we spotlight conversations with creative minds. Today, we have Rick Dugdale is going to be on the show. He is the CEO of Enderby Entertainment. He's a director. He's a producer. He's a writer. He's a lot of things. And we're going to have such a good time today, having a great conversation. So just hang tight and listen to a little jazz, and then we'll be right back. All right. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. We appreciate you. We have a lot to get going to. Normally, I talk and George gets mad. So I apologize. I'm not going to do that today. George, give us some love on to our sponsor and then tell us a little bit about our guests and then let's get them on.
Absolutely. And just so you guys know, I am out of town. So I'm doing this from an undisclosed location.
you're like an adult.
Exactly. Wow. So, but anyway, the Counterparts Show is brought to you by Wellness Resources, a 35-year-old nutritional supplement company that has been on the forefront of clinical nutrition for 35 years. Find out why they are one of the best supplement companies in the world. Make sure you go to myvitaminresource.com. And if you enter the promo code Counterparts, you will get free shipping on all orders. All right. So let's talk a little bit about our guest. Today, we're going to, like John mentioned, we're going to be speaking with Mr. Rick Dugdale. Now, Mr. Dugdale is a Canadian film producer and director. He's the president and CEO of Enderby Entertainment and an independent film finance and production company. He is also the co-founder of Viewly, a premier platform for collecting, watching, and trading exclusive limited edition feature length films and collector NFT film content. In 2021, Rick directed the film Zero Contact featuring Anthony Hopkins, which was the first feature film to be released via the Viewly platform. And John, I watched that film not long ago. So interesting. And I'm very excited to talk about how it was made. So without further ado, let's bring up Mr. Rick Dugdale.
Yeah, and
yes.
We have guys.
Cam Cannon is actually on as well.
Absolutely. All right. Let's bring him on. Yes, hey there he is.
There we go.
All right. How are you?
Great. How are you guys doing? Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, no, this is our pleasure. I'm sorry we don't have a whole introduction for you, Cam, so I apologize.
You know, no problem.
Maybe our next show we'll just open with that. So
just all right. Something in there.
But we want to thank you both for being on. We, as George said, we did see Zero Contact, and man, you know, one of the things that was really the most creepy was that it's the visual that we've been seeing for the last 2 years.
Right,
that's for real.
Visually, that is what we see.
Yes.
Yeah. So there were things in there that look exactly like how my screen looks right this second, except right. It was creepy and the music and everything, and I was like, wow. And so it was very, very well done. I was very impressed with how, I have no idea how you had to direct such a film, but I guess we're going to start first. Rick, I just want to tell us a little bit how that process started. And I mean, obviously we know that the pandemic created the sort of the need for creativity. And that was one way that I thought was brilliant. What was the process for that, getting started with something like that?
Well, you know, first off, I think the thing is that when we made the movie, we didn't think it was going to go on for 2.5 years. And so you kind of, now that it's like 2 years, now we're extremely exhausted of seeing stuff on
Zoom. I didn't think about that. Right.
So that, you know, the process we made it, you know, it was by the time we made it, went through post, it was still, you know, 9-10 months by the time the film was completed. But,
wow.
You know, I think it was week one, I think, of the pandemic. And, you know, Cam and I are partners and he's a talented screenwriter. He's obviously the screenwriter, not just of this film, but many others. And we had a think tank and we had international partners that we worked with, because what people didn't realize is that in Japan, you were shut down. In Germany, you were shut down. And in Sweden, you were shut down. So we kind of had our colleagues who are all, you know, very successful filmmakers join the think tank. And we said, well, okay, how do we make a film if we're going to, you know, be in a world like this? And so we hung up the call. I think you and I spoke that night, Cam.
And that's right.
We started to workshop this idea. Cam ran with it. And 10 days later, we're like, wait a second, this script is not only good, but it's very shootable. And started to put the pieces together very quickly. So moral of the story, it still starts with a good story and a good script. So wow, we had that to work with.
That's amazing. And Cam, what was your, you obviously had to do something that it had to be zero contact with everyone.
Right.
Was that, how was that process for you?
Well, when Rick first mentioned it and we first had the think tank, my initial thought immediately, I went to slasher movie, you know, that, and then Rick told me, no, you can't be that. And so we just kind of toyed around with the idea of, well, what if there is somebody who can go from place to place? And then we were like, well, how does that work? And then, and that kind of led us into the, what if it's this technology that allows somebody to teleport? And then, of course, it's revealed that it's not just teleportation, it's temporal teleportation that they can do. And so we just kind of backed into it. A lot of it came from avoiding the slasher thing that right. Rick was so smart to say.
We figured everybody would probably be trying to make that movie.
Right.
That's, you know? Yeah, that's exactly. Probably, yeah, that's probably
the other thing, too, that was funny is that, you know, you had to have this person travel around the world. So you kind of had, you know, as you can see, it's a different person wearing wardrobe, which is a black right. hoodie that we could assume we could get in every country and be accessible.
Right.
Which is also, you know, not the best photo doubles in every country, but it certainly made it work, you know.
Well, what was interesting was that there was a lot of movement in the film because you have people literally in their homes, you know, shooting, I mean, as a director. But yet with whoever edited, I didn't actually check the editing, so I apologize. But the editor, there was a lot of movement within the actual film itself. So it didn't feel like, it felt like a film that was moving. And I didn't feel like the characters were even trapped at this point. I felt like they were moving around.
You know, one of the things was, is that, you know, even though it was, you know, a few months into the pandemic, you kind of realized right away that whatever we do, it can't feel like you're sitting on a Zoom movie. Mm-hmm. That there would be other people out there making Zoom movies, that we all, even at 3 months in, we're living on Zoom, and it's going to drive people crazy if it feels like they're watching a Zoom movie. So you kind of had to find production value in every little place possible. And that was, you know, camera movement. It was, you know, sound design. You have, we obviously used a lot of stock footage just to get us outside of these spaces for establishing, right. having the drone shots, you know, that takes you out of, oh, wait, I thought it was a Zoom movie, you know. Right. I think one of the coolest things that we experienced is that when we saw the film for the first time in a big screen at the, you know, at the Gromans Theater, actually, and Cam and I were there going, wait a second, this actually, not only does it not feel like a Zoom movie, but it holds up in a big movie theater, which, right. you know, nobody yeah. was going to movie theaters at the time. So,
yeah. Cam, I'm sorry, George. I told you I was going to do this.
That's okay.
I'm
used to it.
One question on when you were writing, you had to be conscious of the fact that every actor had to sort of be their own cinematographer or at least their own lighting. You know, how did you, your thought process as you're writing, did you take that into account as you're creating characters, or was that something that you figured Rick will have to figure out?
At first it was Rick's going to have to figure it out because I wanted to get through it as quickly as I could. Cause we, yeah. you know, we created some pressure on ourselves kind of for the exercise of it, but also just to, you know, just to be moving and be doing it kept our mind off of the pandemic and all the crazy stuff that was going on. So we poured everything into it. And then once I wrote it, it was sitting down with Rick and with the DP, Ed Lucas, and figuring out, okay, this is going to be a security camera. This will be this kind of camera. This will, and then Ed and Rick and I, but mostly Ed and Rick, kind of designed it from the script to what could we, you know, what can we accomplish in each house? How many cameras does this actor have? You know, if he's got, you know.
You know, well, for clarity, Cam, you were a producer too, so you're like, oh wait, right. I also have to solve the problem that I wrote,
right? Right.
So that added a layer.
That's true.
Right. Exactly.
That's amazing. So, What are, I'm just curious to find out, what are some of the obstacles that you had to go through to get this done? Because, I mean, obviously you're dealing with, you know, I know you're traveling all around and trying to, you know, go, I think you were working outside of some people's houses with their Wi-Fi and trying to deal with signal issues and stuff like that. Talk a little bit about that whole process.
You know, I think the biggest issue right from the get-go was convincing people that it wouldn't be a waste of their time.
Right.
You know,
right.
Not that they had, you know, they had anything else going on all the right. days. What were they going to watch on Netflix was the biggest, you know, decision they had.
Tiger King.
But I think
that was huge.
But, you know, the thing was, is convincing them that it's possible and, right. you know, how it's written and how we'd walk them through it and kind of hold their hand. And then it was kind of the technical aspects of, you know, we'd have Zoom calls that were essentially a location scout, and we'd have all the technical department heads on the location scout, including something that's unusual. We'd have the editor. By the way, the editor is Håkan Carlson, an incredible editor from Sweden. Yeah. But like, we'd be on the Zoom for a location scout, and they would walk around with the laptop, and we'd say, okay, great, that's going to work for scene 38. Great. Can you just turn the light on? You know what? Grab the lamp from that room and just make a note. That's going to work in the other room for tomorrow night when we shoot, you know, scene 80 or whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
And then the people, you know, the actors would kind of note it. And, you know, we had a great AD, which is also, you know, made the set feel real. So Artie Carlson, you know, we had a board essentially. And he's like, okay, guys, you know, for scene 38, it's going to be, you know, Alex's, you know, den. And over here, it's going to be his kitchen. And then that was, you know, you would zoom in the next day for the set. And it's like, you know, it's he came out of his trailer, which means, you know, his bedroom and wardrobe.
Right.
And we would shoot. But, you know, convincing people it could be real was the biggest issue out of the gate.
And it's funny because, you know, you're getting Sir Anthony Hopkins on this. And yeah, I'm like, okay, how are you getting him to buy in to this whole vision of this movie?
You know, I think the thing was in the very beginning that the way that we knew we were going to shoot it, you know, each actor by themselves, right? We kind of knew in the back of our heads that there's an opportunity here to save one character for a later date, right? And the thing is that, you know, the way that we shot it, like no actor, because a lot of people think that we just zoomed in and recorded. Right. And then you would take the footage from Zoom or you'd have a camera. But that doesn't work because that's not a releasable film because the quality is not good.
Right.
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 So every actor shot themselves. They never met the other actors. There was like one table read, which was a broken internet feed of a table read. And that doesn't work. But the coolest thing is that you'd have like Chris Brochu, you know, performing this awesome performance.
Right.
And I'm sitting here going, he's acting opposite the AD. Right.
Yeah.
And you realize that this like lack of chemistry because he doesn't even know who's playing the other part yet. Right.
Wow.
And that lack of chemistry is what we've all lived in 3 years.
Right.
This lack of emotion and connection, which I really believe plays into the movie.
Yeah.
Because you see them come together in the end, but they're coming together online just like we've all had to do, you know.
Yeah.
But that lack of chemistry is the coolest thing that I think really worked for the film.
The writing is so great. There's that opening monologue with Anthony Hopkins and there's a lot of sections where it's really, really inspiring. And he's kind of like almost like it's a narrative about what's happening in the world, just in general, like about, you know, being trapped in technology and being a pawn to the planet. And Cam, when you were writing, did you know Sir Anthony Hopkins was going to be saying your words?
I did not initially, but then once we got him on board, we got together and worked on rewrites to try to suit it a little to him. There's a couple of the monologues that that are the same as they were before, but then we couldn't resist, you know, trying to find ways to have him say things that that sound cool coming out of his
like,
advantage of who he is.
Yeah.
And then of course he was really fun with a lot of it too, because he would say, we'd be on the Zoom, we're in his driveway basically, right, Rick?
Yeah.
And he would say, I don't think I'm gonna say that one, Cam. I don't like that one. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
What are you going to say?
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I wanted to actually ask you about the Enderby Entertainment. We're going to, obviously we'll talk more about Zoom, Zero Contact as well, but tell me, I read, you know, I went onto your site and the purpose and the values that's on the page. And it's so inspiring to see that because it's one of those things where, you know, in the industry, you kind of expect, maybe I shouldn't say that, but sometimes it's just nice to see and to read those words on your site that you really care about not only the work, but you care about the crew, you care about the investors, you care about the project, you care about the writing and the storytelling being the most important thing. How did that come about with you and Cam when you guys decided to put this together? Because it's such an important, for me, I'm seeing a lot of different, these agencies, it's such an important thing to read. And I was like inspired by it.
You know, Dan Petrie Jr. is my business partner and him and I founded the company in 2006. We had met in 1999 doing a film in Vancouver that he was producing and was one of the writers on. And I kind of took his lead ultimately. I mean, the Petrie family in general and everything that he has to offer, you know, very gracious, very much the mentorship program. And that was, you know, who I looked up to and our partnership kind of bled into the philosophy of what Enderby would be. And I think it is in our DNA that, you know, we live by the life's too short motto and you pick your partners and you know, every time you make a film, you're really getting married and that marriage is going to bring kids and the kids are going to go to college, which means someone's always going to have to look after that film, you know? And I think sometimes people forget that is that a film, this little independent film that goes to Sundance, what happens to it in 10 or 15 years, right? It needs to be relicensed. You got to file taxes. You got to check the collections, all these things that people don't think about. But as Enderby, we really were focusing on, you know, just working with the right people and developing people that think the same way. And we do a lot of work with the Austin Film Festival, the Austin Screenwriting Conference, for the same reasons. And that is, you know, to try to create a mentorship, to try to, you know, find more team members and just kind of offer our advice and our opinions as to what we've experienced. And, you know, my role is to continue what Dan started and the Petrie family in general. Started. So I think it's probably what makes us unique a little bit. You know, we don't get to make movies without collaboration and that includes investors, you know, look after the people you work with.
Yeah. It's important. Cam, how was your involvement?
I met Rick and Dan, several years ago when I was working for another company and I, Dan was kind enough to ask me to do a rewrite on this project we were doing with my old company. And the movie never happened, but I just stayed friends with Rick and Dan through the years. And then when there was finally room, I jumped ship and came over. And it was because of the very values that you see written about on the website. It was, you know, life's too short. The old job wasn't always very fun. I got a couple of movies made. I wasn't always happy with them. It was a kind of place where there's a lot of these where they're making a product more than they're making a film, you know, not to sound too artsy, but you know, you got to get this guy and this guy and have an action scene every 10 pages.
A plus B equals C kind of thing.
Right. They're not necessarily focusing on the experience of the story. Right. They're focusing on what going to draw, but don't you find it that in recent, I don't know, just recent months, actually, I guess that people are really want to get films that actually inspire, and have a different take, like, you know, the Marvel series, it's such a huge, huge thing, you know, but you kind of understand it. And I love it. I have a 5-year-old son. We geek out on it. So we love it. But, you know, when you have an organization that can really storytell with a purpose, I find it that Hollywood, maybe not Hollywood, but there are organizations that are doing that more. Is that something that I'm just lost here in Nashville seeing?
I mean, I think personally that, like, society is getting smarter and the culture is having a comeback. and interest in other topics and other pieces of storytelling and art are becoming more appealing to the younger audience. Yes. And I think, you know, the theater business is going to have a comeback in a big way. And obviously Maverick and the Marvel movies are making that happen. Right. But there's an interest that those 16-year-olds are having for non-Marvel movies, you know, and I think that's going to bode well probably for next summer. I think you're going to see more films in movie theaters that aren't Marvel movies, because right now that seems to be all that there is. And of course, the theater business needs that, because coming out of COVID, you need to fill the theaters. Otherwise, there won't be a theater business. But people are getting smarter and they have a wider appeal in terms of interests. And I think that's driven a lot by the streamers that are providing international content. You know, Squid Game is a massive hit. That's a South Korean show.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, I think the 16, 17 year olds, where are we in 5-10 years when you still need to get them to come to the theaters? They're not probably fully interested in the Marvel Universe at that point, or they're, at the very least, they're going to have a wider interest, I think, ultimately. Yeah.
And culture is having a comeback. I love that. That should be a t-shirt. Great.
There you go.
George? But, you know, it's and I think you're right, because even I have a 15 year old and she, you know, she, you know, loves movies and stuff like that. And earlier on, you know, when she was a little bit younger, she would like the Marvel stuff. And but I noticed that she shied away and she's watching more now, a lot of more meaningful storytelling, you know, whether it's movies or TV shows. I've noticed just by what she's watching, and I'm like, but then I ask her, you want to watch a Marvel movie? She's like, yeah, whatever. So it seems like she's even having that shift, which is very, very interesting. And it's funny as a dad to watch that shift, you know, in her.
Yeah. It's human nature.
I think you're seeing like the, you know, look, there's, it's not just film and entertainment, but like youth are leading. They don't want to be led.
Right.
And it's exactly. Like the entertainment that we provide for them, like they're just getting smarter. They're on to the, you know, social media marketing trickery, just like maybe 20 years ago. Wait a second, that bus stop shelter ad and that billboard, I don't need to look at that and see the ad, you know, and they, people still spent millions of dollars doing those, but the eyeballs aren't, you know, like they used to be, because that was all you look at. You wouldn't look at a thing called the internet that we now deal with, right? So I think you're seeing the youth are onto that. And so they're now focused on, what do I want to see, not what do I want to be told to see?
Exactly.
You're seeing that big shift, I think, right now.
Yeah. And Cam, as a writer, what are your, how do you look at this shift, so to speak, as a writer? Like, are you, because this film was really sort of like a different kind of almost like a genre that didn't really exist, that kind of like you almost like invented in a sense. moving forward, how does that work?
I feel like people are going to be starved for, look, the Marvel movies are great. I complain about them, and then I like almost every one of them when I finally watch it.
Yes. You know, they're great entertainment.
They know what they're doing. Those guys, they know what they're doing. But I also, I've got a 19-year-old son, and now he's like, geez, Thor movie, another Thor movie?
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And he would rather go see stuff like the Blumhouse stuff. And,
right.
Because it's just been, when I was a kid, there weren't a bunch of comic book movies. There was Superman.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
And so, you know, I wanted that to be, but we're now we've got a generation of younger kids who all they've ever known is comic book movies. Mm-hmm. That's all they've ever known. And so it's probably like Westerns were in like the 60s, where they just kind of got phased out. It's like they, you know, we're tired of cowboys. We're tired of it.
Yeah. That's interesting. And you know, my son even recently, the new Hawkeye, I told him, you know, new episodes, you know, and he was like, oh, okay. And he wasn't as excited, you know. He has the action figures and everything, and he doesn't play with them as much. So there is this idea of something that is so much of it that it almost gets watered down to see somebody fight 1,000 people and save the day. And it's sort of like, yeah, we saw that last time.
Right.
You
can't have the Super Bowl every weekend.
Right.
You know? It's not an event. Exactly. It's not an event if there's one every week and there's 10 of them streaming at the same time on Disney Plus. Now, it's just not the same.
We should say, and a shout out to our dear friend Alex.
Alex, Bonavir, yes,
no, we'll be true. Happy to get your 5-year-old son the Tracksuit Mafia signed action figure. So, Alex, I'm sure you're listening or will watch this on repeat. I'm sure we can make that happen for your 5-year-old son.
Alex was cool. He actually reshared one of the things that I shared on social media. So nice. We appreciate it. So
yeah, he really wanted to be here. He really wanted to be
here. That's cool. He's great. And Gen Zeros, I think I was checking that out. I was like, I was like, this is awesome. And that actually leads me into NFTs, because this is really an amazing thing. It's something that I've heard about. I've heard of Gary Vaynerchuk talk about it. I've heard of all these other guys, I'm in the space, and to see that this film and to see that it's an NFT product now, tell me a little bit about how that started.
We made the film, and once we saw the outcome of it, we realized that maybe it would be a disservice to release this film in a traditional sense. And we were fortunate enough to be working with some tech guys involved in this space. And I reached out and said, hey, listen, what would it look like if we had, you know, a 95-minute NFT? And what is that cost in fuel? And how does this work? And within a couple of days, we kind of had a structure laid out to build this platform called Viewly. And ultimately, you know, it took about 6 to 8 months to build it. And we launched on OpenSea as kind of the billboard to Viewly. Mm-hmm. And now Viewly's been operating since February, March. And it's, you know, going through the process and being part of Viewly, you realize this is probably a real way to release your movies. Going back to what we were just saying about the youth, you know, it's like the 16-year-olds are okay with digital transactions. They're okay with digital content. Mm-hmm. You know, does every 16-year-old have a hard wallet and NFTs? No, not necessarily. But that mindset, right, moving forward in 4 to 5 years, it's not a big deal to own an NFT. You know, and it won't be called an NFT in 4 to 5 years. It'll have some name that'll be, you know, less the stigma behind NFT and Bitcoin ultimately.
Yeah. And I have an 11-year-old daughter, and she's on, you know, Roblox. And so she buys a fancy hat. Well, that fancy hat is a digital, it's an NFT, you know. And so, of course, it's all going to go in that direction at some point. You know, I think that I find it exciting. At the same time, I find it a little confusing. Because, like, what can you add into it that provides more value, not just for the 16-year-olds and the kids that understand it, but for the older generations that are still want to, some might want to go to a drive-in at some point, but, you know, just want to go to the theater. That still, I don't know how that balance is gonna go.
Well, you know, first off, I hope the 11-year-old didn't have that transaction on your credit card. Watch for more of
my credit card,
because then you do have a whole NFT collection. Just happens to sit in her wallet. I think the thing is that what people, you know, trying to understand NFTs and what's the difference from the Lionsgate release in our case, and Lionsgate's a great partner that we worked with, and the NFT community. And let's talk about Web3 too for a second. Web3 and the future of where we're going with things is essentially, to sum it up, is there's many ways to define it, but it's almost a decentralized world, a decentralized globe with no borders, which means kind of open honesty, transparency. Imagine a world of positive culture and positive in nature, with no negative feedback and reviews and trolls and bullying online. That's really where Web3 is going, right? And so the NFT offering in a film, and the magic word utility that we all point to, what does that mean? And what is the utility for this film or this, you know, Bored Apes, right? Or the Jack Dorsey tweet. There was no utility with that. And then you question, well, why has the value gone down? It was just a piece of paper on a wall. There was no utility. It didn't get you dinner at Jack's house or anything like that.
Right.
So the NFT holders in our films and every film that Viewly releases, we look at it like a treasure trunk of utility. And you open it up, and if it's a film that's in development, here are the things that you can add to your list of utility, right? If the film is completed, that's going to have a different set of utility. A few things at the crossover, but you're not coming to the set because the film's done, right? And then there's maybe a sequel. In our case, like, you might be able to get a ticket to Antarctica because you're in our community and you're growing with us and we're listening to the community. So it's a lot, you know, it's a lot different than a traditional release, because it allows us to connect with the fans when they leave the movie theater. When you go to see Maverick, you go to see Marvel, you leave the movie theater, you're gone. You don't connect to the distributor or the movie makers, but right, you're going to stand by to see the next Marvel movie. So it's really about like engaging this community that's along for the ride with you. And you give them something, they give us something. Positive in nature, future of Web3, give them an NFT and build a community.
Yeah, and value will increase as the time and also the product, the project itself gains a whole life in itself. And so it's all about investing in that product.
Yeah, at the very least, I mean, we you know, we never sell NFTs to say, buy now, it's worth more later, right? We're right, providing, an NFT that has utility. Yeah. But you know, when you buy a Blu-ray, what happens after you've watched it a couple of times? You're either going to give it to your buddy, it's going to go to the cottage, or it's going to be at a garage sale for a dollar. That's the extent of the life of a Blu-ray. An NFT, if you continue the community and you continue the brand and the product and you build from that, it will always have a life. Is the value going to exceed that you purchased, what you purchased it for?
Right.
Then more than likely, if you have that community around it. And also scarcity, there's only so many of them.
Correct. So like if you had like a, like baseball cards in a sense too, you know, it's like we have the rookie card and that's that one rookie card and it's in mint condition. Well, there's the value right there. You know, somebody that you didn't know was going to become, you know.
You know, somebody. when you were a kid and you're collecting, you know, the basketball set, did you know that there was only 1,000 Michael Jordan rookie cards made? Right. You didn't know that as a kid. Right. You just kept spending your allowance trying to get the one. Exactly. But it's like, no, there only was 1,000, right? Yeah. So it's like the Willy Wonka ticket. You need the rich guy to buy the factory of chocolate bars to get the ticket, you know? And that's because it was scarce. And that mindset is where we're going. But everybody collected the set, but you missed a couple because there wasn't that many.
I remember just eating that hard gum and just putting the cards down. Who knew? Yeah. Who knows what I had there?
Yeah.
A million dollars.
Or making on your bicycle. Right. Making the motorcycle. Yep. It's exactly. Like, damn, that was a Wayne Gretzky rookie card, like, you know?
Can you imagine?
Yeah, there goes that $2 million card. But hey, at least my bike sounded good.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
George, I got one question. I know
you. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I want to actually ask, because Cam, you had mentioned earlier, I'm going to put up this. You had mentioned earlier pressure. You put pressure on yourself to kind of like write and to kind of get things going. Because I think during the pandemic, I think it was one of the traps that a lot of people kind of ran into. I started this with George and we were like, well, we got to do something. We got to go meet people. We got to do something, you know. We're both musicians. We played in bands together and we recorded records. I'm a filmmaker. So we're very creative people. What kind of pressure did you put on yourself to say, okay, I want to get this done by this? You know, how was that a difficult thing during this pandemic with all the uncertainties that were going on?
I wouldn't say it was difficult because I don't mean that to sound like, you know, this is easy for me. It's not difficult because I love to do it.
Right.
I love just sitting in my computer and figuring out a story and, you know, and then seeing how was it, Rick? How was it? I think I bugged him like the day I turned in the script. I would send him a Slack every 10 minutes. And have you read it yet? Are you reading it? Cause it's just fun. Pressure might not be the right word.
It's an interest. It's a drive. It's a passion.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy was a drive. A drive is you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
To be clear.
Yeah. What was that?
He's the fastest writer you'll ever meet who delivers like A grade stuff, you know? So it's like when he delivers something, you kind of need to drop everything and read it because it's really damn good. And they will say, how the hell do you deliver this in 10 days?
Wow.
Which is a good, you know, writing in Antarctica, you know, Cam basically wrote, you know, chapter 3 in Antarctica under those frozen cold conditions. But there he is writing, part 3, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, George, I'm going to give you a chance.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. No, just actually two things. One, Cam, I was just wondering because you in one of the things that hit me with this film was the father and son relationship. Mm-hmm. That one really hit me because it kind of reminded me of similar stuff that I went through with my dad. When, you know, my dad has passed, but he, you know, kind of really him and I had a rocky relationship and didn't do a lot. And so that thing kind of hit me. So I was just wanted to know a little bit about, you know, the thinking behind that also. But just another question before I lose it. And again, this is the musician in me that I just noticed it. 3 out of the 5 people on that film had guitars behind them.
Yeah.
Okay. Was it done by design? And how? Yeah. And what was the whole point of
that? Yeah, Alex had a really nice ESP.
Yeah, exactly.
He almost smashed.
Yeah.
I was like, that was a nice bass.
Yeah, that was supposed to be like a literal axe, wasn't it, Rick?
Yeah. What do we have to worry about this?
Right.
Your bass guitar. Yes.
It was perfect.
Yeah, you know, by the way, Alex was in a band, right? Years ago.
Yeah.
And they've re-recorded new songs.
Yeah.
He'll make, he hates when I say it, but it sounds like Sepultura. If somebody could pull up, I'm sure it's on a Spotify or on his Instagram. He's in a band, like a hardcore rock band. It's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, I've checked that out. And I've also, he was also a boxer and comes from a boxing family. And yeah.
Sure does. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a very creative guy. We're going to check all that out and we'll tag him on stuff. But okay, George, your question was about father and son.
Yeah, just curious about that whole, that piece of the father and son thing, how that came about, or just, you know.
I had my father passed away also. I had an amazing relationship with him. So never went through anything like this. But it just, honestly, it feels like fatherhood is, it's a really strong theme to me, because we live in a world where, just my opinion, we've devalued fatherhood a little bit.
Right. Yes.
And,
agreed.
And so it to me, it resonates because it's so, because of that devaluation, that I perceive, you guys do too. Not everybody agrees with us, but you go back to like Field of Dreams and movies like that,
that last scene,
you know, when explore that. Oh yeah. And so that was kind of the inspiration, was, I didn't have a dad like that.
Okay.
But just, you know, kind of thought from, came up with the Finley character first.
Okay.
When we were talking, that was one of the first ones he came up with. And then when we had to start with the, when we were coming up and talking about the other characters, I had the idea for the son being the proxy. And then it was like, what kind of dad would this guy have been? I don't think he would have been, there all the time.
Right.
And so then it was just natural to explore that theme once I had thought of those two characters. It just felt like the natural way to go.
Yeah, because it really hits you, especially when you look at, okay, this guy is, you know, a driven guy, the father's successful and driven, and he's making all these things happen, but at the expense of the family dynamic, maybe, mm-hmm. or the relationship with the son. And then later on, where he actually says, you know, I wasn't there, maybe, he kind of admits, you know, I wasn't there like I should have been for you. And it's a very pivotal moment in that movie.
I think you're spot on too about the fatherhood. You know, I never met my dad, but my grandparents raised me, and my grandpa was my dad, and he was amazing, and it was awesome. I remember my stepdad who's passed, and I won't say anything negative, but there was a lot of issues there. And I remember always thinking to myself, when I have kids, I am going to be so different.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that that's lost.
Yes. Like,
we're not. Well, you know, and I don't want to get into a whole thing, but I mean, George and I talk about it all the time, because we're from the South Bronx. We grew up with like nothing, you know, we had to fight our way out. And I just thought to myself, you know, why would we grow up and be mean to our children or ignore them? I'm going to treasure them, you know?
Exactly.
And so anyway, that in the film, when he's, you know, he starts crying and I think, you know, he realized that he really put a lot of effort. Of course, he made him a time traveler. So I mean, my grandpa
provided something.
Yeah, you know, my grandpa, he bought me a guitar, but he didn't, you know, I couldn't time travel. But
Bruce, you just killed it in that scene, man. He just crushed it.
Yes, man, I agree.
You know what, Ken, that was the scene where, like, we're all zoomed in, and you had the, you know, Tink, the production designer, the editor, the whole production crew is on Zoom. And Chris, who is a dear friend and an amazing actor, just like crushes it, pours his heart out on Zoom. And you just look around like the Brady Bunch. I'm looking at each screen and everyone's just like, like, yeah, that's when right. we knew
yes.
this is going to work.
Right.
Right.
It was like, because.
And everybody bought in at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was really fun shooting all of it. And like when we were doing Alex's scene, or even Martin Steinmark. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And there was, you know, we were all on a Zoom and we're laughing and joking. And then for most of Bro Shoes, we're doing that. And then we get to that part and it's just like, you could hear a pin. Everybody was just, you know, nobody was laughing anymore. Nobody was, there's my daughter.
Yeah. And I could actually envision that, you know, just what would be going on in the back in the behind the scenes, because of how emotional some of those scenes were, how scary some of them were. I jumped a couple of times. But at the same time, like, I know in the back, you know, there has to be either nobody there or there's some, you know, everyone.
Or the wife.
So it's really amazing. I know we only have like 4 minutes because I know Rick has an appointment. What are you guys working on now? And where can we see it? I know, obviously, I'm going to put up the website. But what are you working on now?
Well, first off, Viewly right now is we're onboarding more titles, and that's going to be a really cool experience, kind of going through the process, releasing a bunch of new movies on Viewly and making that a consistent thing where you can build a community and ultimately be part of your finance plan when you're making movies. And that's a lot of the questions is how can you use that to help finance your film? So that's really exciting stuff that we're doing at Viewly.
Yeah.
Enderby, we are gearing up for maybe 3 to 4 films before the end of the year. It's pretty busy over here. We are, you know, post-COVID, still dealing with, you know, COVID costs and stuff that are associated with production. But you're seeing a big, you know, rush to get content. A lot of these distributors, you know, obviously didn't have content through COVID. So it puts us in a better position. But we have a few films coming up that we'll be announcing, one in Cuba and possibly one in Europe. And then also what we're really excited about is Zero Contact 2 and 3. And that's going to be done conventionally, not over Zoom, I hope.
Right.
But that's we did start with the Antarctica portion. We pick it back up in the fall, globetrotting, taking the audience to places that they haven't been before, possibly.
Yeah.
So that'll be a fun ride to continue this world of Zero Contact.
Yeah, I love it. It's the reset, right? And then I saw it was a poll. And pole, I think it was.
Pole to pole. Part two, the resets, part three. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Awesome. Yeah, well, I'm definitely looking forward to that. So, Rick Dugdale and Cam Cannon, thank you so much for being on the show. We really, really appreciate you guys taking the time to chat with us.
Absolutely.
You guys are awesome. We're going to be following. We're going to be promoting all this stuff. We're going to be clipping this up and sharing it everywhere. And we just thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having us, guys. It's a pleasure. Anytime, we'll do it again. So we really appreciate it, too.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great
week. Take care, guys.
Take care.
Bye.
Oh, those guys are awesome.
How about that, right?
Love it.
It was great to get an insight on how that all was done, because when you really watch that film, it was just incredible.
Yeah, especially on the you know, being a CEO of a major company like that, you know, where you're doing independent films, but you're also doing big films. You got big actors. Ben Kingsley, I didn't ask about Ben Kingsley, but I wanted to know because Sir Ben Kingsley is like one of my idols too. And, you know, but just being in that world is always good to see how level-headed, and that's really what you do. That's really where you can actually get that kind of product from being in that type of personality. You know, maybe I'm overly excited, but I get excited. As you know, George. All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. Thank y'all so much. We'll see you all again next week, same time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Counterparts. George Batista, thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. And as always,
peace.